Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio 89.1 FM, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts today, Cynthia McClure, together with my co-host, Susan Franzen. We have an unusual collection of stories today about unusual vehicle reuse. So you want to talk about that, Susan?
During the past few weeks, there have been three front page stories about vehicles in Nevada, Iowa that were donated or purchased as used for very different purposes than their original intent. There was a story about the pink fire engine featured on the front page of the Nevada Journal, and the working bikes collected in Nevada made front page news in the Ames Tribune. But the biggest story, which was front page news in both the Ames Tribune and the Des Moines Register, as well as KCCI News, was
the MRAP vehicle.
And Cynthia, can I turn that over to you now?
Sure. I politely ask our county sheriff, Paul Fitzgerald, to come in and talk about this new vehicle that is available for people in Story County in an emergency situation. What kind of situations would you use that vehicle, sir?
Well, first of all, MRAP is an acronym. It stands for Mine Resistant Ambush Proof Vehicle. And originally developed for the military. And the reason it was developed for the military is because of all the IEDs in Afghanistan and Iraq. And it was killing or seriously injuring soldiers. And so in order to address that issue, this vehicle was created. And now that we're pulling out of Iraq and even coming back from Afghanistan, the government has a large number of these vehicles in surplus. And what they do, it's called the 1033 program that the government has, where they work with local and state public safety agencies. And if there's a need for excess surplus military equipment, the law enforcement agencies can put in a request, and the military will notify us when the items that have been requested are available, should they become available, and then we're put on a list to get one. Story County was fortunate to receive one here recently, and at this round, we were one of, I think, five agencies in Iowa that received one of these MRAPs.
So what do you see this as a role? Its use here in Story County.
Well, what we see, first of all, the only time that I hope this vehicle ever leaves the premises is for training. I hope we never have to take it off the premises to go into an actual situation where it's needed. The intent of this vehicle is basically for a rescue vehicle. Law enforcement is a dangerous occupation, and we've seen that last year with the murder of Deputy Stein, and where he, the sheriff, and the chief deputy were going up to talk with a domestic violence situation where a person with mental illness was involved. They engaged in a gun battle. Deputy Stein was shot and critically injured, and the sheriff and the chief deputy behind their vehicles were exchanging gunfire and about out of ammunition. They had to retreat, and Sergeant Stein, who had been, like I said, critically wounded, was in fact instantly killed, had to be left there while law enforcement came in around and was able to go up and actually assault the house in order to retrieve the body and to take the individual into custody.
So you hope to avoid these kind of situations?
Absolutely. And so what this does, had an MRAP been available, would have been a perfect vehicle to drive up between where the officers were and the house and the individual. It's a bulletproof vehicle.
These can take a lot of punishment then.
This can take a lot of punishment. I don't know of anybody around that would have a large enough caliber rifle that would be able to do any damage to this machine.
But this is only a rescue vehicle. It's not meant to shoot at anybody.
No, we don't. We don't have any ports that we can put muzzle barrels through to shoot out of. Or in our perception of this is purely rescue. And whether it's an officer down or whether we have a shooting situation where civilians would have to be rescued out of an area, this would be something that you want to have available, but that is when you have, you're in the middle of a situation, that's not the time to start looking around to think, where can we get one of these? And so what we have, one in Story County, Jasper County has one, Marshall County just last week received theirs, Scott County has had one for some time now, and
these are not fast-moving vehicles either, so having one in Story County is helpful?
Well, they're not. They're, you do have to have training to drive them. They're not a sports vehicle by any means, but their top speed 65 miles an hour, and it's an extremely heavy vehicle, so like any large truck, you want to make sure that, you know, you have the ability for stopping distances and things like this. So,
well, that's one of the detractions of this vehicle because it's so large, it can't fit on a lot of roads and a lot of bridges.
Well, it will fit on all roads, but you're right, there are certain bridges in the rural areas of the county where this cannot go over. We've been in contact with the county engineer. We were in contact with the engineer in the city of Nevada, and we have the county maps, and we have it highlighted which bridges are not capable of or designed for the weight of this vehicle. And there's not that many of them in the county, but there are a few. So if we do take it out, we have to look at the map to see what route we're going to take to get out there and make sure we avoid those bridges that don't have that weight-bearing capacity.
Well, the weight brings up a question. Is this much heavier than a large truck?
Well, the vehicle, the information we received from the military is it weighs 56,700 pounds. The person who delivered it, after their, you know, the military stripped down its equipment in there, weighed it on its truck, and he said it weighed 50,000 pounds, 25 ton. So it's a big vehicle. But if you look at a cement mixer full of concrete being delivered, you know, around the communities, and you know, that's basically what we're looking at. And so it's that kind of a heavy vehicle, you know, a large dump truck with filled with gravel or material, and there are vehicles that go around the community every day that are of similar weight. And so anyway, that's where we are, and we have this over at the sheriff's office.
Well, you mentioned earlier that you got this through the government.
Mm-hmm.
So do you own the vehicle?
Yes. This is, when you say, do I own the vehicle, Story County is a recipient of this property that we see from the United States government. It's through the sheriff's office, and it's under my control like any other vehicle in my fleet is. So, well, what we do, it's in law enforcement, we operate a lot on mutual aid. One agency needs something, another agency nearby would have it, we assist, whether that's personnel, whether that's equipment, depending upon what the situation and the need is. Much like the fire department. You know, in the smaller communities, you have a large fire, you might have two or three fire districts that are responding to the scene. That's mutual aid for public safety. And if there would be a need for this type of a vehicle, that would be reasonable areas to respond, we would certainly send that vehicle to help other law enforcement officers. Last year when the Maynard Bank was robbed in northeast Iowa, and they had several law enforcement agencies, even some from Minnesota that came down, that were chasing these individuals, the FBI sent their MRAP from Omaha, all the way from Omaha to come up to northeast Iowa. So anyway, we have a few more of these available. And like I said, our intent, our hope is that the only time we have to take it out is for training. But if the need is ever there, as sheriff, I believe it's also my responsibility to make sure that I do everything I can to ensure the safety of my deputies and law enforcement in Story County, and also for the citizens that we serve and protect in Story County.
Very good. That's comforting, actually, to know, because there's a perception of law enforcement in here in America becoming more militarized.
Well, you know, it's law enforcement is a profession that over the years has evolved and will continue to evolve. And you're certainly correct, because there are people that are saying that our local law enforcement are doing things that mirror the military. Well, law enforcement has always been set up to be a paramilitary organization. We have our ranks. We have our command structure. We do things, a lot of things in a similar fashion, but it's for local control and for protection within our own jurisdictions. The military is basically there to protect the United States from foreign aggression. And this is the difference. The military does not come into the United States and take law enforcement action. We have some. With our drug task forces, we work in some areas with some military, like flyovers and this.
Oh, yeah.
But it's very clear. The military has no armed role in this. They have no where the military is coming in against its own citizens. This is just something where they will fly law enforcement over an area to see if there's a marijuana grow or something for surveillance. But absolutely no contact, no confrontation with the citizens. Local law enforcement is put into those positions from time to time. And like I said, it is at times a dangerous profession. And
with the loss of life, like you mentioned earlier,
absolutely,
of the police officer.
Absolutely.
In a domestic violence situation where the man was mentally ill.
Yes.
So what do you see the cost of having this vehicle for Story County? Because there's you initially got it for no cost or mm-hmm. just for shipping costs.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to have to train people to drive this safely mm-hmm. because of the way the vehicle is, it's prone to being flipped.
Top heavy.
It's in a V shape. It's a design issue.
Yes.
So you have to train people not to hurt themselves or get into mm-hmm. a situation that
any,
is
any
potentially.
Any equipment we have, we train our people with.
And so how many people are going to be, well, what do you see as the cost of this?
Well, when we first got it and I went out and when it was delivered, when I looked at it and on the side door they had the sticker on it, and one of the things on the sticker was the initial price was $773,000. And it kind of took me back, but here again, when I looked before, over the past several years for what the civilian model of this is called the Bearcat, or a similar type armored vehicle to protect officers. I believe Des Moines has a Bearcat. And
yeah, it's
some
the
other
Lenco Bearcat,
yeah,
which is about $200,000.
Yeah. I mean, they're very expensive. And so obviously, there's no way I, as an agency my size, is going to be able to afford one of these.
Oh, no.
So this is where it's so nice that when the government, through their surplus program, the 1033 program, that agencies like mine and like we've seen others around the state of Iowa that have been able to capitalize on that. So we received this vehicle literally at no cost. It was when you work with the surplus military and you find equipment that you want, it's that agency's responsibility to go get it. The military does not deliver it to you. And these were brought back into Texas, and at the base at Texas is where they were being distributed at. So we looked at it. It'd probably take two or three people to go down there, because driving it back, you'd have to trade off.
Because it's kind of rough to drive.
Yeah, it'd be kind of hard to sit in a 15-hour ride and driving that the whole time. So, that, you know, two or three officers would go down, stay overnight in a hotel, then drive it back, and maybe, you know, one night coming back. And there's a possibility of, you know, something happens on the road. So for risk mitigation, we thought, well, let's look at some transport companies. And we had one that would do it for around $5,000. And so when we looked at the personnel cost, the fuel going down and back, especially coming back with it, but
because it's not a cost-saving device to run.
No, it probably gets about 5 miles a gallon.
It's so heavy.
It's got a 78-gallon tank. Yeah, it's a huge truck, like driving a dump or a cement truck or a large dump truck filled with gravel. But anyway, so we decided we would pay it back. So there's a transport company right down by the base that hauls big equipment like that. They gave us a price of $5,000. We paid for that. and brought it back. Now, we have some prices that we looked at because we're going to have it painted. It's going to be painted just like our squad cars, the sheriff's office, white with the gold stripes and sheriff rescue on the side. So it's not going to be having the military colors on it anymore. But our first bid to have it painted from a place that does large trucks in this is $14,000. So I thought, well, maybe the military color isn't that bad. But then we had another guy that come over and said, hey, I'll do it for half the price. And so we have somebody that's more or less community-minded that's helping us out and works at a body shop. So he has the vehicle now, and it's being painted. And so the $7,000, $7,500 to paint this, I'm taking out of drug forfeiture funds.
Oh, nice.
Seizure funds. So it's not tax dollars. It's just monies that's for law enforcement that we got from drug dealers, and by Iowa code, that money can only be used for things that are non-budgeted. So this is a perfect thing to use that for.
So do you see this being used in those kind of situations where you have a drug situation and people are armed?
Well, it depends. Every situation in law enforcement, whether it's going to a domestic violence call or a burglary call, or whatever, every call is different. There's no canned response. I mean, you may do responses similar, but you're never going to come into the same exact call. Everything's going to have a little bit different twist to it. And whenever we plan a drug raid or, excuse me, if we have a warrant for an individual that's a real bad guy, and we have certain matrix that we put together, and we score so many points to show what type of level of force our people need to be prepared for. And if we're just going to have a couple of officers or deputies go up to the door and knock on the door and tell the person we have a warrant for your arrest and take them into custody, or if this is something that we need to bring in one of the SWAT teams to go in to take this person. A few years ago, Mason City Drug Task Force was doing a multi-raid on a drug case they were working, and they were hitting 9 spots simultaneously in Mason City. So they had their SWAT team, the area SWAT team, they had the State Patrol bring in 3 SWAT teams, the FBI brought in 2 SWAT teams, and they needed a couple more, and with the reputation our unit has, they called down and asked if we'd come up too. So we went up there, and 9 SWAT teams gathered and hit 9 different residences simultaneously. Not a single shot was fired, not a person was injured, and bad guys went down. So
that was a dream kind of situation, best scenario.
Yeah, and, you know, the point is, in law enforcement, we train. We prepare, and that's why we have the equipment we have and the people trained with that equipment so we can enhance our safety. It's not for machoism. It's not for being to show everybody how tough we are. But when we go into an environment, we want the people trained. We want them appropriately equipped because we want the odds stacked in our favor that we're going to be the ones coming home. Officers out there working, a lot of people may think of them as robots or, they're just the cops out there. Hey, you go around to any department and you'll talk to those cops and they'll say, yeah, I get off in a little bit and I go get my kids and we go down to softball, diving. My girls are playing softball and my boys are, in football here tonight and, we got,
They're They're connected with their communities.
Absolutely. And I tell you, I've been to a number in my 38 years of being a law enforcement officer, I've been to a number of law enforcement officers' funerals. And when I was in Waterloo with the Waterloo Police Department, there was 2 officers killed one night. I was at that call a half hour before when we changed shifts, and the next shift got a call back there, and both officers were killed. And then when they were hunting the individual in the cornfields, a deputy sheriff was killed in a car accident responding to a report of a gunshot. And so, It, like I said, it's not always a safe profession that we're in, but that's what the public expects, and that's what the public pays for when the wolves are out. This is what they bring the police in for, is to protect the citizens from the bad elements of society.
Excellent. I just have a question about the training. How many people on your staff are going to be trained to drive this? Because it is a specialized vehicle. Mm-hmm. Do they need special permits or licenses or skills because of the the possibility of rollovers and the cost of driving it?
In Iowa, the type of licenses you need are basically just categorized out on the usage. First of all, it's by weight. A vehicle weighs so much, and you need certain types of licenses. The truck that we have, or the vehicle that we have, the MRAP, is of such weight you need a CDL license, a chauffeur's license to drive this. And so we have a couple of people in the office that have CDLs, and we have some other people. Everybody was taken out to training, was trained how to drive it and shown how to drive it. And, of course, we'll keep training and working with that. But there's some others that are working to get their CDL as well. The code states that if we have an emergency or we have a need for it, anybody can drive it. That's law enforcement. So as long as anybody, an emergency that we're responding to or a crisis situation, then anybody goes on, they don't need the CDL. But if we're using it for any other purposes, like when you drive out for training, we got to have somebody that has a CDL drive it to the training spot. And then when we're in the county property, then anybody can drive it for the training purposes. But anyway, so that's where we're going at. Our SWAT team in Story County, we have 12 members on the SWAT team, and they've already had one training day with it, and they'll be having some more. When the military, we got it from the military. I got a couple letters. You know, people were concerned about militarizing the sheriff's office and using military equipment against the citizens. Well, that's not the intent of what we're doing here. The things have been taken off of the vehicle.
Yeah, the gun turret.
The turret was removed, and that's not available to us.
And you can't fire out, you said earlier?
No. The only way we could fire out of that is the top of the vehicle, where the turret used to be, that portion opens, and so we can have somebody stand up. So I'm looking to see what we can do to put something up there, because if we ever have to have somebody stand up to look through there or to navigate as we're going up to a residence or something, I want them to have some protection up there. So we'll see what's going on. But
like on a submarine, have one of those, you know, periscope cameras.
Well, we have the availability to put different types of cameras on there for going into situations like this. But if we ever would need to return fire to protect, again, if we have the availability of having the equipment there that will provide protection, we will certainly use that however we can to best protect the officers. But I had one letter that a person has talking about militarizing the office, and they said, and this vehicle, that's all equipped with top secret experimental equipment that you're getting. And no, it's the vehicle is completely stripped down. It's a hollow shell. All it is armament on wheels.
And so basically, it's got thick armor to protect the officers.
Yes.
And anybody else caught in a situation where they could be harmed.
Yes, absolutely. And the full intent of this vehicle is for rescue purposes. And if we need to go in to rescue somebody to get them out, or to maybe use it to deliver officers up to the door on a raid or something like this that's dangerous and the potential of gunfire, that's what we will be using this vehicle for.
So what design do you have? Because there's like three different categories of MRAP. Which one do you have?
Big. it's the one we have, they come in four-wheel designs and six wheels. When we were looking and having the only ones available to us was the six wheels. So we got the six-wheeled MRAP.
So you got the biggest MRAP.
I've not seen one bigger. But it is big. It's a six-wheel. It's six-wheel drive, so it can virtually go anywhere. We've joked about getting a V-plow for the front of it, so in the wintertime when our deputies are stuck out in the road.
Yeah, I was going to ask. You could use this in a blizzard situation.
We could use it in a variety of situations, absolutely.
So it's fairly unstoppable, but you know the detractors of it, you know, because it will flip on its side and because of design flaws in the way that the ladder is, do you find it hazardous for the officers to use? I mean, you're bouncing in this over rough terrain. People could be hurt inside it, because soldiers have been hurt while driving in Afghanistan and Iraq,
mm-hmm.
and just being tossed around.
Sure. And this is where there are eight seats in the back. on the side, you know, the canvas style seats. Mm-hmm. And so those are attached to the side and officers can be strapped into there. They have two seats up front, the driver and the passenger in the front support seat. And like any vehicle, if you take proper care and restraint, you're going to be okay. The seat belts will hold you in this. But also understand, when we deploy this vehicle, it's just not out for patrol and it's not out for just an afternoon cruise. This is because we're going on a very serious mission. And so in this case, certainly there's always going to be that risk. But the officers will be prepared with the necessary equipment that they need so when the back door opens, they can get out and deploy and either rescue the person that they need to or to be used to take if they're being driven up to a location where they got to enter on a raid or something. So
this is just safety transport vehicle and also rescue vehicle.
Yes.
Okay. Do you have anything else you want to share with Story County and or our listeners about this kind of vehicle or if they're, you know, if they have concerns?
Well, we continue to try to deliver the most cost-effective equipment here and that we can in the county. I've always been able to give back portions of my budget to the general fund at the end of each fiscal year. This year I anticipate we will have a significant amount to give back as well. And that's because throughout the year, not only me but my staff work very hard in looking to where we have other resources we can use, grant funding that we can use to offset costs, and we do everything we can to minimize the cost, but at the same time, we also want to receive quality equipment and quality training.
You want to survive your shift.
Absolutely, and I want my people to survive their shift. You know, if there's a situation, it's not me that's going to be going into. I know, you know, I used to do that years ago, but as sheriff, I'm management now. And but so my belief is that as a manager, my responsibility to get my people the training, education, and equipment they can to serve the public that we have. And we do that in the sheriff's office. And because we do that, Story County Sheriff's Office is second to none.
Excellent. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate your time and clarifying some of these issues.
Well, if you'd ever like to come over, I know they can't see it on the radio, but if you would certainly like to tell them more about it, you can come over and get a first-hand experience. We'd be happy to take you for a ride in it sometime.
That would be a dangerous offer.
you might have more takers on that.
Yeah. I may even get a chauffeur license to drive that thing.
You get your license and you come on over.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
We've just been talking with Story County Sheriff's Officer, Sheriff's Paul Fitzgerald, and I appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you very much. I appreciate coming in and I hope you guys have a great day and a great, safe Memorial weekend.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have been listening to KHOI Community Radio, where your hosts, Cynthia McClure and Susan Franson, have been speaking with Story County Sheriff Paul Fitzgerald about the new armored vehicle, the MRAP, recently acquired as an Army at the Army Surplus from the Department of Defense through the Defense Logistics Agency.
Later, we'll hear about a unique bicycle recycling program also in Nevada. Now, we'll be speaking with two of the dedicated volunteers of the Nevada-based group, Story County Responders Care. They'll tell us how their work with the national organization Pink Heels inspired the Huxley Fire Department to give them a 1963 fire engine to be painted pink. And I have to say, when Paul Fitzgerald was talking about the $14,000 offer to paint their vehicle and some generous person would paint it for $7,000. Well, we'll have to hear how the 1963 fire engine is going to get painted.
Nice.
And I'd like to start out by playing a little bit of an interview with Melissa Spencer, who talked to me last week over in Nevada.
I got involved about 3 years ago. I had heard through the fire community that Wes was looking for volunteers to help with selling T-shirts initially is how I got involved. And then he wanted to do some additional fundraising efforts and wanted to help get the word out. So I said, well, I'll kind of maybe act as a public information officer, so to speak, and, you know, help write some press releases and things. And, you know, I've had several family members that have died from various cancers, whether it be breast cancers, ovarian cancers, lung cancers. And so having an organization that was focused on cancer as a whole for women and the journey that they're going through and supporting them and giving them love and compassion was something that struck home for me. And so to get involved, it was just something that it was just logical for me to do, and I've thoroughly enjoyed the last 3 years of the long work and long hours. But last year was our first year with the national tour, making home visits, and that's a feeling that you can't experience any other way. And so it's just important for me to continue to help support women in our community and stay involved with it.
What is the Pink Heels Group? Is it a national group?
The Pink Heels Group is a national organization that helps support local, mostly fire, law enforcement, EMS type organizations with fundraising activities within their community for cancer. Again, like I had mentioned before, it's not just specific to breast cancer. They use pink to be the identifier for women as a whole. And not just breast cancer, it's every type of cancer they support. And by bringing the pink trucks in, it gives a lot of visibility to the local effort and gives a lot of support. And, you know, they spend basically from about March to November traveling all across the country. And they will actually be coming, we're working right now to have a stop here in Nevada probably sometime in August. We're still working out a few of the details. But it's just nice because they give us some visibility, they give us some support, and help us spread that message across the country for, you know, for the activities that we're doing that are happening locally.
And we already have a couple of names that are going to be our first stops.
The last voice that you heard is Kay Fleischman, who is a volunteer with Melissa. But her story is of her own experience of being visited, of being a cancer survivor. She got to know Melissa as a volunteer first responder in Nevada. So they have that in common as well. But this is Kay's story.
My name is Kay Fleischman. I am a 7-year breast cancer survivor. I have worked for different cancers most of my life. My sister-in-law passed away August 25th of 2006. The last words that she verbalized with me was, "Go get your mammogram." She died on August 25th. I got my mammogram on the 10th. I got my diagnosis on the September 25th. On October 25th, I had both breasts removed. So this is pretty personal to me. And we want people to know that the truck will be pink, but it is not just for breast cancer. It is for all women in their journeys through their cancer battle. It is not just for pink cancer. So I've been involved with Wes and Melissa off and on and sold T-shirts and a few things like that. And when he approached us in January, he said, "I think we need to take it a step further." We jumped, and here we are. Plus, I also got a visit, a surprise visit from the Pink Heels Tour, which is a national tour that goes through. So that was really emotional. And I can hardly say it still without crying. But I hope that we can touch other people's hearts and souls as much as I have been touched.
After hearing Kay's story, you can understand the mission of these two women.
and the Ames fireman Wes Hubbard to use pink activities to support women with cancer. Another aspect of this project is the way it has stimulated cooperation among fire departments, police, and emergency medical services throughout the county. And here's the story of the pink fire engine.
This was an effort that was started by the Ames Fire Department, and the support from the Ames Fire Department over the last 3 years has been incredible with moving this forward. But we're now finding 3 years into this that we have a lot of other departments, fire departments that are interested in helping. We have law enforcement agencies that are interested in wanting to step up, and some of our first responder organizations, the EMS folks. Want to step up and participate. And so we've looked at, expanding it on beyond just being Ames Fire. We're looking at expanding it to be more of a Story County responders care. So other departments will feel comfortable coming into and helping support the organization. But we owe a huge debt of thanks to Ames Fire Department for the initial support and kicking off these efforts and allowing us to continue to grow this beyond just the city of Ames and being able to get all these other departments involved.
I noticed that the fire engine was donated by Huxley. Now, is the Huxley Fire Department involved in this except in the sending of the vehicle?
We hope so.
We've had support from them as a fire department. They've come to some of our fundraising events. Our event this last year with the national tour stopping here, we had several local departments bring trucks out, including the city of Huxley brought a truck up to the event, along with several of our other local fire departments. Their former fire chief has been very supportive in participating in our car cruises and just being the fire chief, being very supportive, having his membership bring trucks to some of our rally events. So I would say they're involved and they're supportive of the organization along with several of the other fire departments. It just so happened this was an opportunity that they had a truck that they needed to kind of dispose of, and they're like, what better way to have this truck? I mean, it still ran. It was still a good truck. It just was not good for fire service anymore. So it was, well, this is a worthy organization. And when we started having this discussion, the chief was like, I have a truck for you if you want it. It's yours. 1963 fire truck. And it's like, okay. So we got the truck and then no sooner got it home and somebody was willing to volunteer the paint and the labor to paint it, because we were already having discussions on how we were going to take care of that. So we started to have some more expanded support from the fire departments, and even law enforcement from the other communities have become involved and want to participate and be supportive. So it's truly becoming more of a county-wide organization than just Ames firefighters.
One of the things I want to make sure that we talk about is, how does the repurposed fire engine fit into our plans? It will be a traveling billboard covered in signatures of people whose lives have been touched by cancer. When we come to visit or we find someone that needs a home visit, we'll be going either to homes, hospitals, hospice houses, and making our visits. We want to bring more attention to our cause. We need other people to get our word out there. If you know somebody that needs a visit, we'll be on Facebook, we'll be in the paper, anybody can get a hold of us. We'll have cards, we'll have our numbers on them. We have to have the people that we can go visit. And each time we visit someone or the truck makes a stop, we'll have a permanent magic marker. And they can write their name or an angel's name or any loving memory name, and it'll always be there in the truck.
Is this an all-volunteer organization?
Yes. The three of us are all volunteers, yes. Wes, Kay, and myself are all volunteers. We do this on our own time. You know, some of the other folks that we're now starting to get some more support as our mission is growing larger, are all volunteers. We are all doing this because we have a passion for it, or we've been personally impacted. So our organization is starting to grow, but we're a mighty three right now.
And we'll say, we need more help.
we need volunteers to help with just about everything at this point.
And how can they get in touch with you to volunteer?
They can contact Wes Hubbard through the his email at Wes_Hubbard, H-U-B-B-A-R-D, at hotmail.com. Or they can go to, if you're a Facebook follower, you can do a search for Ames Firefighters Care, and you'll see our webpage come up, and that's a way certainly to contact us as well.
My name is Kay Fleshman. My phone number is 515-231-8068. We would love to hear you either about your story or wanting to help us.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. So far in the program, we've heard about the two large vehicles in Nevada that are seeing new duty, the MRAP recently purchased by the Story County Sheriff's Department, and the 1963 fire engine from Huxley that will bring its second half century, bringing a message of cure when it's painted pink and taken to visit women with cancer.
For the last part of our program, we went to Story County Fairgrounds in Nevada to the Goat Barn to meet Richard Atwell, who will tell us the local story of working bikes.
My name's Richard Atwell, and I live in Nevada, Iowa. I'm retired. I started into picking up bikes when I read an article in the paper. Mount Pleasant Correction Facility was looking for bikes. I called them. They wanted 100. I put some posters uptown on Main Street, put an article in the newspaper, collected 100 bikes, called them, put them in a trailer, and hauled them to Mount Pleasant. And that was the start of this. And then I hauled some to Fort Madison Penitentiary. And then from there, I read an article in Des Moines paper that Working Bikes in Chicago, a nonprofit group, were looking for bikes. And I called them, and they said get 160 adult bikes and call us. We'll send a truck out to pick them up, and I have been doing that now for over 8 years.
Do you have any estimate of how many bikes you've collected?
Well, so far I have shipped them, them being Working Bikes in Chicago, over 6,500 adult bikes. Presently, 3 weeks ago, we shipped 275. I presently have 120.
Where do you get your bikes?
The bikes come from the good people of Story County and the county surrounding Story County. There's articles that are written in newspapers. I have a sign I put on the truck that I use in parades, word to mouth. Now, with the help of a radio station, the people will call and say, hey, I have bikes. Where do I take them? Sometimes they just show up in the alley behind my house.
Are these bikes mostly in good working condition, or do they need repair?
The answer to that is both. A lot of them are bikes that have been in garages. They've been hung up for years or sat in a corner of a barn. A lot of them need new tires. They just need to be gone through, possibly new cables. Sometimes the chains are rusted bad. They need new chains. Chicago, they just go through them. The first priority Chicago has, these bikes are going to go to Africa, Latin and Central America, and the Caribbean. And in most cases, there is not good roads to ride on, so the first priority of Chicago is make sure that the bike has a good frame.
Do you have a team to help you get bikes in repair, or do you send them in any condition?
We send them in any condition from Nevada. As long as it is a frame, rims, tubes, parts, seats, we send them to Chicago, and they are the ones that fix them. They check everything out. They take everything. And last year they shipped 6,500 bikes. That's 13 containers. They use 40-foot containers. The countries in Africa, Latin America, Caribbean cannot handle 53-foot containers, which is the new container you see going by on the railroad. They use 40-foot containers. They can get 500 bikes in a container. A container going to Africa costs $8,000. A container that is going to Latin America and Central America costs $5,000.
How is Working Bikes in Chicago funded?
They're funded by good people in Chicago. They're funded by a lot of volunteers. They do have a retail shop where they sell some bikes. Fairly cheap. They sell bike parts. That money is used for getting the next container. When they do ship a container, they ship all sorts of extra parts that goes with them, tires, tubes, chains, seats, cables, everything. They ship a lot of extra parts. They have trained people in Africa and these different countries how to repair bikes or how to fix flats.
Could you describe the place where the bikes are stored?
The bikes are stored at the 4-H grounds in Nevada, Iowa. The 4-H board has allowed me to use one of their facilities that has a cement floor, and I get to use it as long as I take good care of it, which I try very hard. Approximately 11 months of the year, they let me know when I need to be out, because when the fair comes, they have a cleanup night where all the buildings are cleaned out and the pens are installed. Whether I'm in the goat barn, but there's also cattle and sheep barn, pig barn. Once the fair's over, they have a week or 2 weeks to get it cleaned out, pens put away, and then I'm allowed to move back in. The gentleman that works with me all the time is Don Hale. He is a retired dentist from Nevada. And not too long ago, he turned 90 years old, and he's still riding a bike.
When Richard said goodbye to me, he handed me a brochure from Working Bikes, which is the organization which distributes the bikes collected in Nevada. I could see another story there of ways our discarded bikes from Iowa can change the lives of people in Africa and Latin America. So I called Marie Ackerman at the Working Bikes Warehouse in Chicago. We're calling from Iowa. So I guess we really need to find out what's happening to all those bikes when they go to Chicago. First, how did you get started and how long ago?
Working Bikes was founded in 1999. It started in the garage of a couple here in Oak Park, a suburb of Chicago. Lee Ravenscroft and Amy Little decided to start collecting bikes rather than having them get thrown away. So they started out by purchasing bikes from the scrapyard. And gradually this sort of grew and grew, and the expense grew. And so eventually they started repairing the bikes and selling some so that they could continue to purchase more from the scrapyard and then in turn donate those at the time through this organization called Pastors for Peace. And so after about a year, a couple years of that, this operation grew. A group of volunteers was helping Lee and Amy, and the numbers of bikes they were collecting grew. And so they moved into a space in Chicago, and then they were there for several years, and now we're in this warehouse. And we donate about 5,000 bikes a year at this point.
About 5,000 bikes a year. Mm-hmm. Now, the organization that you mentioned, Pastors for Peace, used to come through Ames, Iowa. And I knew people who provided school supplies and medical supplies for their project then, which was taking these supplies to Cuba, which was against U.S. government policy at the time, so they took them to Mexico so that they could reach the people in need in Cuba. So that was your first overseas contact?
So far, that's what I heard from our founder, is that it was Pastors for Peace initially. And it grew from there. So now we work with multiple international NGOs. One of them is Bikes for the World, which is based in the U.S., but works with a lot of organizations internationally. And they are based in the East Coast and do kind of the same thing as we do. Another organization is Village Bicycle Project, which is stationed in Sierra Leone and Ghana. And so primarily the organizations we donate to are in Africa and Latin America.
What do you want to have happen to the bikes when they reach their locations?
The organizations that receive the bikes do a variety of things with them. Some of them disassemble the bikes and turn them into bike machines that can generate electricity or pump water from underground. Some of them will repair the bikes and have a job training program for that so that people can gain a skill set as a bike mechanic and then go on and find employment opportunities with that skill. And other people have staff mechanics, and their organizations will repair those bikes and then sell the bikes. And then that generates income for their community, for other humanitarian causes in that community, and also just generates economic development generally.
How many locations do you have?
We only have one location. Working Bikes is based in Chicago, but the recipients for our bikes are around maybe 10 countries or so. Africa and Latin America are the continents that receive bikes, and some of the countries are Ghana, Sierra Leone, El Salvador, Cuba, Panama.
How many places send bikes to you, like Nevada, Iowa?
Nevada is actually one of our rare out-of-state drop-off locations. We have a couple in Iowa and a couple in Indiana as well. And we occasionally get bikes in Wisconsin, but most of our drop-off locations are in Chicago and Illinois. We have about 50 in the Midwest in general, and many of them are bike shops that are generously provide space for us to store bikes. And then there are a lot of individuals too, like Dick Atwell, who collect them on their own.
You mentioned that the founders actually purchased bikes from scrap dealers. Do you find that necessary anymore, or do you get almost all your bicycles donated now?
Yeah, we don't do that anymore. After a couple of years, that stopped. We started working with Rotary Clubs in particular to do what we call bike drives. And now bike drives and drop-off locations are our main source of bikes. We don't buy bikes. We don't do trade-ins with customers. So what we do is we just collect them mainly from colleges, towns, where police departments have collected bikes, park districts, and then lots of individual donors who contact us and ask us to come and pick up 5 bikes or 10 bikes.
Is your enterprise growing? Do you have more countries, more bicycles each year, or is it pretty stable?
It's pretty stable. It grew for quite a few years, and now it seems like we've plateaued at this point between 5,000 and 6,000 bikes. Our countries remain about the same set of countries that we're donating to in general, but what we have increased is our local donations. In the last few years, we've started donating more bikes here in Chicago, and this was largely in response to movements to get youth more active, to get youth doing physical activity, riding a bike around their city, and then also just in the rising need for accessible transportation. So Working Bikes model is to sell about 20% of the bikes that we receive, and the proceeds from the sales fund our donations. So we are a 501c3 nonprofit, but the majority of our financing of our operations comes from our sales rather than from donations or foundation grants.
And what are your expenses?
The expenses basically are our staff. Initially, we were just volunteers, but at this point, we have a staff of about 10 individuals, 4 of whom are full-time. And we also have our building, which we purchased a few years ago. And it's a warehouse space that has a dock, so we can do shipments right from the back of our building. And it also has the storefront up front, and then storage for the couple thousand bikes that are in the building at any time. And then, of course, there are utilities expenses there, and then also the shipping costs. So we pay for a large portion of the shipping that we do to our international partners.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts today, Cynthia McClure, together with my co-host, Susan Franzen.
We've been talking with Sheriff Paul Fitzgerald about their departments.
The MRAP.
With Melissa Spencer and Kay Feldman talking about the Pink Fire Engine of Story City Responders Care. With Richard Atwell and Marie Ackerman describing Working Bikes.
Local Talk is engineered by Rebecca Brown. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can also listen to this show and all other past local talk shows online at our website, khoyfm.org. That's khoyfm.org. where you'll find an archive of all of our local talk shows we've produced since we went on the air in 2012 on our website. Recent shows will be posted on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, can get that information. There you'll find a list of our guests, their phone contacts, and links to the organization.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or at the email khoiradio@gmail.com. Your participation as audience is what makes KHO possible. Thank you for listening and see you again on the radio.